From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. What do you say when someone asks, how old are you? Takes you off guard, doesn't it? Seems intrusive and rude. The writer and activist Ashton Applewhite says we react like that because our culture carries all these messages that say getting old is a problem. Well, today in the program, Applewhite is joining us to talk about ageism and how aging itself is a process we should embrace, not be ashamed of. We'll be right back.
Have you added a new smart speaker to your home? They're amazing, right? In fact, you can make your Amazon Echo, Google Home, or Apple HomePod even smarter. Ask it to play KUER. Your digital assistant will serve up our live stream filled with the latest news and brain-expanding shows like Marketplace, Radiolab, and All Things Considered. To find out more about how to use your smart speaker, go to KUER.org and click on How to Listen. Or just tell your device to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ashton Applewhite says all of the isms, racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, all have the same thing at their core, this assumption that all members of a group are the same. She says this is how it works with ageism, discrimination against older people, which is something Applewhite has been exploring now for more than a decade. There's this idea that all older people are, you know, frail and out of it, that they're clueless about technology and pop culture, that all of their usefulness has been spent. In her book, Applewhite says, like all the isms, ageism is a socially constructed idea. In other words, these stereotypes, they're not real. They come from a constant barrage of messages about older people in commercials, on TV, in hotels, in hospitals, in the workplace. Applewhite is pushing back on ageism, debunking myths, and trying to start a movement, really. Her book is This Chair Rocks, a manifesto against ageism. She joined us to talk about it. Applewhite has written for Harper's and the New York Times. She blogs at This Chair Rocks and at Yo, Is This Ageist? She joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. And she says her journey to fight ageism began about 12 years ago after a conversation with her mother-in-law.
What really got me started, which of course typically I only realized in hindsight, was that I was afraid of getting old. Mm. And it was a chance comment of my mother-in-law. She and her husband, Bill, were in their 80s at the time and they're booksellers. And she said, why don't you write about something people ask us all the time? So when are you going to retire? Mm. And I realized that that was a sort of optimistic, soundbite-friendly way to sort of dip my toe in the waters of aging and oldness. And I started interviewing people over 80 who work, and they were a dime a dozen, which wasn't really surprising, and in the world in all kinds of interesting ways, which likewise wasn't particularly surprising. But what knocked my socks off, because I was also researching longevity, because that's what I do, was how much of what I thought I knew it would be like to be that old was negatively skewed or not nuanced enough or off base or just flat out wrong. And I thought, why on earth don't people know these things?
Yeah. You came to this realization that you had internalized these things, which gave you a sense that what? That this was kind of cultural, our impressions about age.
Well, exactly. I mean, we are bombarded with negative messages about aging from birth on, really. I mean, children's books, Disney cartoons, this stuff starts young. And by the way, ageism is any judgment on the basis of age. Mm-hmm. So young people experience a lot of it, too. It cuts both ways. And unless we stop to question this narrative, it does become part of our identity. And it's really at its foundation as ugly as the idea that we age out of having equal value or even value at all as we get older. And, you know, that isn't a world that I wanted to live in. But we are all ageist, just the way we're all prejudiced in all sorts of ways.
Right.
And the very first step, which is the most uncomfortable, is to look at our own attitudes towards our own age and aging, because we can't challenge bias unless we're aware of it. And to realize the way in which you know, we are somewhat complicit in promoting and believing these negative messages without thinking about how the culture in which we grow old shapes those messages and why.
Yeah, you say you were prejudiced against yourself. You came to this realization.
That's the weird thing about ageism. All prejudice is based in what sociologists call othering,
right.
Seeing a group of people as other than yourself, other color, other religion, other sports team. The strange thing about ageism is that the other is our own future older self. Ageism takes root in denial, which is, of course, not rational or sensible, not that any prejudice is rational or sensible, in denial of this idea that we're going to get old, whether we just don't think about it or whether we think, well, if I do enough sit-ups and eat enough kale, somehow I'll be different. And that is where we distance ourselves from our own future self. And that's what gives ageism a toehold in ourselves and in the culture.
Mm. We should mention this. It's kind of a caveat. You're not pretending aging is easy.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. but what you are saying is that these are cultural ideas. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, this was so interesting. It seems like, I don't know, and maybe this is wrong, that there's this fear of dying that seems to be the heart of a lot of this anxiety about growing older. But you say in the book that that's different from the fear of aging. Fear of dying is one thing. Fear of aging is cultural, if I get that right. Would you explain that?
I think, yeah. Well, I think humans, you know, all cultures, all humans fear dying. I think that's part of the human condition. You know, yeah. It's why we have religion.
Right.
But aging begins the minute we're born. It's not just something annoying that old people or your parents do, right? Mm-hmm. Dying is a discrete biological event that happens only at the very end of all that living. I mean, someone might look at me and think I am really, really ancient. I'm 66, but they don't look at me and think I'm dying. I believe that the conflation of aging and dying, that somehow our aversion to getting old or our unwillingness to associate with older people, I don't think it's rooted in fear of mortality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think those are two separate things. And you know, in another one of those interesting things that I learned early on, I thought, well, one of the awful things about getting older must be that you get closer to death, which we are. You know, older people are reminders of mortality.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that aging and dying are, you know, the same. Those fears are quite different. The longer people live, the less they fear dying.
Yeah.
Which I thought was fascinating. I thought it would be the other way. The knowledge that time is short does not fill people with dread, which was an ageist assumption I started out with.
Mm-hmm.
It makes us spend our time more wisely. And that's also true of young people with a terminal illness. A lot of changes we once thought were rooted in age are not.
So interesting. You write about this later in the book, that what you call the gift of a bounded future, this gift of knowing that the future is not endless. At some point, this will be over. And that's a gift, which I think that seems so counterintuitive.
Well, you know, it's both. I wrestled for a long time about whether or not that was a paradox. At one time when I was really struggling with all of this, my working title was Both Are True, because,
yeah.
You know, aging is how we move through life and interact with each other and institutions. It is the biggest canvas there is. Each of us has to age in our own way, at our own time, make our own compromises. There's no right way to age. There's no successful way to age. That's one of my least favorite terms, is successful aging.
Mm-hmm.
I say if you wake up in the morning, you're aging successfully.
Right.
You know, but despite all the negative messages that we are bombarded with, I have never met anyone who actually wants to be any younger.
Yeah.
No matter how unwoke they be, and you know, not many people have spent as much time thinking about this as I have, because we know that our years are what make us us, and we know they're precious, and most people actually really like being the age they are. Older people.
Yeah, right.
It's hard to be 20.
Exactly.
You know, ageism affects us lifelong, and you know, it's good to be reminded how hard it is to be 20. You know, and when you're, one of the things that makes it hard to be 20 is this cultural narrative that if you're not having, you know, peak sex with your perfect body and getting your perfect career lined up, it's all going to be awful really soon, when that is absolutely not the case. But it's one of the things that makes being young harder, and it's ageism.
Yeah. I know this sounds obvious, but What is age? Because you say in the book that, of course, it's real, but you also say it's not a fixed characteristic. You say it's an observation that we use to kind of place ourselves relative to others. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
That's a great question. And it's one of those things where both are true. The very simple question of, you know, what do you say when someone asks how old you are? Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to give the number. And I got a really sharp I received a really sharp answer this when I was on my book tour last month to how to answer how old are you. Say, I was born in 1952. If you happen to be my age. The person who asked the question spazzes because they can't do the math.
Yeah.
But at the same time, getting the year, you've answered it, and getting the year enables them to reflect on just how long you've been around and how much you've seen, stripped of the ageist or possibly negative connotations we have when we hear that someone is X years old. You know, we are all older than some people and younger than others. Age is a spectrum. But on the other hand, age is not just a number, another phrase that I'm not crazy about, because mm-hmm. it does reflect the number of times you've circled the sun, and I think it's important to claim it.
Yeah. So what do you say? Maybe you just come right out and say it, but then do you also ask, well, okay, I'm this age, why does that matter?
Yeah. I think that's a great question to ask. Or, you know what, I mean, I sometimes say to people, I'm happy to tell you how old I am, although I think I'm going to use the number of birth thing from now on, but because it's clever.
It's a good idea. Yeah.
But I am happy to say how old I am, but I often say, if you'll tell me what changed in your mind once you had a number, or, you know, why do you think you need the number? I like to point out that, you know, I would like ages taken out of newspaper stories, unless it's an obituary or a story about a prodigy, but we think age is relevant when it actually isn't. And journalists hate this idea. They say, no, it's part of the who, what, when, where, why. But I like to point out that we used to put race in newspaper stories.
Yeah.
And we don't anymore for the same reason, because we all make assumptions. We are all prejudiced. And when you're stripped of the number, you are not able to say, oh, gee, that's typical or atypical for a person that age. When in fact, you know, very little is typical of any individual at a given age, except very young people. And the longer we live, the more different from one another we become socially, biologically, cognitively. Mm. So the older a person is, the less that number tells you about what they're capable of or interested in or much of anything about them.
Ashton Applewhite, her book is This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from the local and national businesses around the state that underwrite our programming. Shows like Morning Edition, Radio West, and All Things Considered. If your business or organization cares about the in-depth local news and fascinating conversations you can only find on public radio, team up with KUER. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, look for the support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer and activist Ashton Applewhite. We're talking about her book, This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. You know, before we get any further, I want to make sure I get the language right, and I'll just throw a couple of these out. The elderly. You're not crazy about that.
I'm not crazy about it for several reasons. It might be, if we didn't live in an ageist world, it might not have a negative connotation, but to me, it does connote frailty and fragility.
Yeah.
What I especially dislike about it is the in front of it, because it implies that older people belong to some homogenous group when nothing could be more different from the truth. A bunch of 18-year-olds have so much more in common than a bunch of 28-year-olds who are far more similar than 48-year-olds and so on.
Yeah.
So to imply that there's some point where we fall off the cliff and become elderly or even just old, which shouldn't be a dirty word either, is problematic. And I also – I have a pretty good rule in these fraught politically correct times to try to call people by whatever they call themselves. And I've never heard anyone describe themselves as elderly.
Yeah. What about seniors?
You know, nobody likes senior.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I don't love it. One of the reasons I don't love it is because it implies that young people are junior.
Right.
And I don't think there should be any hierarchy around language and around age. Same with those, you know, this annoying seats. I live in New York City where there's an annoying sticker on the bus window that says, "Won't you please give up your seat to the elderly or handicapped?" You know, I think it should say, "Won't you please give up your seat to anyone who looks like they could use it," yeah. Which could be an 18-year-old who sprained his ankle, right? It could be anyone. Let's look at people as individuals rather than try and, you know, stick a number on them and attach a fixed meaning to that number.
You've settled on the term, and may not be perfect, but olders, I guess, is what you like.
It is perfect. Yeah. You have asked me. I have solved two problems in the course of 12 years of working over this, and that is one of them, what to call old people. When I was writing my book, I literally got tired of typing older people, which I think is the only acceptable term, or older Americans, and I started shortening it to olders. Everyone knows what olders and youngers mean. One thing I like about it is that you just referenced that age is relative. You know, the 103-year-old woman will assure you that she is younger than Mrs. McGillicuddy down the hall. A 4-year-old will assure you that he is older than those babies in the corner. So it breaks down this old-young binary, which does not exist, but which everyone lives on in terror, you know, of being on the wrong side of this imaginary velvet rope that segregates us and fills us with needless dread. So I really like the way it emphasizes that age is a spectrum. Duh. And lastly, it doesn't prioritize or privilege old or young, right? It's not elder is a beautiful word. A lot of progressive people in aging services use it. It's not part of my culture. And lastly, a lot of us don't want to identify as old, but almost all of us with more road behind us in the head will acknowledge being older. And that is a way to get over that hump, that othering, oh, not me, I'm not old, the age denial. Right, that helps us to identify with the fact that, of course, you're aging. Thank heavens for that. And how can we do it with open eyes and an educated point of view so that our fears are not out of proportion to the reality? Aging is not easy. I am not a Pollyanna. But all we hear is the alarmist and negative.
When we look back at human history, let's go back several hundred years. Did we have the same kind of anxiety about age then?
We did not. We had a lot less old age.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it's an incredibly population aging. In the 20th century, the American lifespan increased by 30 years. Population aging is a permanent demographic global phenomenon. In the U.S. 150 years ago, most people didn't even know how old they were. There were one-room schoolhouses. There were no nursery schools. There were no old people's homes. Better public health meant, for the most part, other things as well, that we started living longer. Industrialization, urbanization, capitalism all conspired, if you will, to segregate old and young, to divide us in ways that we had not been divided before. And, of course, that kind of segregation is never good for the group with less power. And we see this repeating all around the world. I mean, people often say, isn't it great to be old somewhere? It can be, you know, there are cultures that have a tradition of ancestor worship or honoring their elders. It's also, generally speaking, more true in African-American culture here, certain Asian countries. But everywhere that capitalism and urbanization have marched in to separate the generations, you do see ageism popping up. And the flip side of that is that where people live in small communities, where we're in contact with each other, where the value of a human being is not pegged to earning a conventional wage, you know, doesn't have a fixed economic weight to it, which, by the way, eliminates all the incredibly valuable work that older people do, looking after other older people, volunteering in their communities, looking after their grandchildren so the kids' parents can work, et cetera. When we have a broader view of the value of a human being and see the way each of us contributes lifelong, which you do in smaller communities than a big city or than a suburb where people are isolated, though that's a very good thing for older people and and people who are not necessarily economically visible in other ways.
Mm. It's interesting that you were writing about how older people in other times, before the printing press, for example, before books, mm-hmm. they were passing along these oral traditions. I mean, so they were thought of as held with esteem, thought of as incredibly useful. So interesting the effects of technology on the way we think then of people.
Yeah, I mean,
older.
There's a theory, the grandmother theory, that it was in the Paleolithic era that Homo sapiens first started to live long enough, which was only to about 30, to have grandparents. And that's when this great leap in making art, making music started to happen, because suddenly there was more sort of human capital around, to not only to tell you where the mammoths were, but to, you know, keep the kids out of the fire. And it enabled us to enrich our culture, learn more, and live longer.
One of the things that you talk about is kind of the shift that you went through in this process from the personal to the political. And I wanted to ask about the political dynamics here at play, because you mentioned, this is how you put it in the book, ageism is woven deeply into our capitalist system. Explain how.
Well, if aging is seen as a problem, we can be persuaded to stop it or fix it, to buy things. And if aging is seen as a disease rather than as natural transitions, you know, if the natural transitions are pathologized, then we can be persuaded to buy stuff to cure or fix it. And again, no judgment about people. You know, there's lots of legitimate medical reasons to have hormone replacement therapy, for example, or, you know, if you use Botox, plastic surgery, if that's what you need to do to make you feel good about who you are in the world, no judgment at all. But those things cost money, right? And no one makes money off satisfaction. We are going to have to shake up, you know, if people were happy with how their face looked when they looked in the mirror, the skincare industry would take a huge hit. Awful lot of hairdressers who make an awful lot of money dyeing women's hair just to cover the gray would lose money. You know, people are, of course, always invested in the status quo. But those remedies are expensive. Those remedies are futile. And, you know, eventually, I mean, I did a thought experiment on Facebook. I thought, wouldn't it be amazing if the world saw how many of us have gray hair? I mean, it must be 2/3 or 3/4 of the world. Mm-hmm. And how diverse we are and how beautiful we are. And wouldn't it be fantastic to have the year of letting our hair go gray? And I put it up on my This Chair Rocks Facebook page, and I got a ton of blowback, which I totally deserved. I'm not in the business, I learned very quickly, of telling other people what to do. People said, you know, you go first. So I did. I dyed my head white, actually. I still have brown hair, ironically. But the fact is that, you know, hundreds of thousands of women, I'll talk, and men too, you know, dye their hair just to cover the gray. It's expensive. They experience it as tyranny. And behaviors like dyeing our hair to cover the gray, or lying about our age, or leaving early accomplishments off our resume. Again, strategies that are really effective in an ageist world, no judgment. But they're like a gay person trying to pass for straight, or a person of color trying to pass for white. They're not good for us because they're rooted in shame about something that shouldn't be shameful. Mm. And they give a pass to the discrimination that makes those behaviors necessary. A lot of people make a lot of money off problematizing things that ideally, in my opinion, should not be problematized. And that's why it's going to shake things up. You know, it's also ageism paired with sexism helps women, you know, pits workers against each other. It's one reason that, you know, people are able to exploit women in the workforce and pay us less. Women stop getting promoted to managerial positions at 34. And we are subject to what economists call the attractiveness penalty. You can imagine what that means if we make the hideous mistake of appearing to visibly age. All those patterns abet the people at the top who run the companies who make more money if they can pit workers against each other. Mm. Ageism is profitable. Racism is profitable. Patriarchy is profitable.
I want to go through some of the myths you try to bust in the book. here, too, society is going to be swamped by all these old people. You hear that all the time. And this one, that an older population is going to bog everyone else down in caring for the sick and frail. Now, you go after these in direct ways. Break these down for us, if you would.
There are real challenges raised by this massive longevity boom. But it is not true that older people are inevitable pits for health dollars. One common myth is that healthcare costs are rising in proportion to the aging of the population. That is absolutely not the case. Mm-hmm. What is the main driver of higher healthcare costs in the United States is the use of technology, is high tech. It is not population aging. We do need to think about the kind of supports that an older population is going to need. There's a whole initiative out of the World Health Organization called Age-Friendly Cities. Age-friendly cities have social services and public transportation, and they're accessible. Those things are the same things that make a city or a town good for commuters, good for families, good for athletes, good for people with disabilities, right? So the stuff that's often framed as good for expensive old people and why are we going to spend money on old people who are going to die soon, they don't say that part aloud, mm-hmm. are in fact the things that make a community or a workplace better for everyone. And people aren't just living longer, they're living healthier as well, you know?
We'll talk more about this healthcare part because there are at various parts in the book you talk about how ageism basically casts the problem of old people just refusing to die, basically, or dying in inconvenient ways. So what do you make of the argument or the case that you hear all the time that, you know, why should we spend money on old people who are just going to die soon anyway when we could spend it on kids? Or and the argument that you often hear about, look, why use all these extraordinary measures when people are in the last hours of their life? Because these things come together, it seems.
Well, I would separate those out. I mean, you do hear this old versus young logic cropping up around healthcare rationing in the way you just put it. Why should we spend money on old people when we could spend it on young?
Yeah.
Here is my argument to that. I would nip it in the bud right there. It is not legal or ethical to allocate resources by race or by sex. Of course, it does still happen, but we know it's not okay. It is no more ethically or acceptable to allocate resources by age, period. So the entire ethical premise of the argument is invalid. People do not lose value as human beings because they made the hideous mistake of getting old.
Right. So then to the question of, do you use extraordinary measures on people in the last hours of their life? Because I guess that's different, is what you're saying.
You know, that is different. I like to think that my work, which in a way is helping people to look at aging. I mean, instead of closing your eyes and wishing that it was, you know, never going to happen, mm-hmm. sort of like the monster under the bed when you're 6 years old, lift up the bedspread. You know, there is a monster. You're going to get old. Some part of your body is going to fall apart. And you're going to lose people you've known your whole life. Mm. Those are real monsters, but they are the only two inevitable bad things about getting older. If we become early in life what I call an old person in training, if we acknowledge, just acknowledge, you're going to get old. You can, that older you can be a speck on the horizon, 100 miles away, a million miles away, then you don't get stuck in this denial frame of mind. I think that that conversation then paves the way for talking about what we think we're going to want at the end, which and a lot of these extreme interventions take place partly because they're profitable, mm-hmm. partly because medicine isn't very good at talking about dying. It's mostly about, you know, living, and because a lot of us do not talk about what we think we'll want at the end. I used to be super smug. I'm like, well, I have my, you know, my medical power of attorney and all that set, and I sat my kids down, and they didn't want to be there, but I said, okay, pull the plug. And my son said, well, what if you're hit by a cab tomorrow? And I said, well, I want that liver transplant. He said, well, Mom, that would be an extreme intervention. And of course, he's right. It's an ongoing conversation. And by the way, the kids said the next day, geez, we really didn't want to do that. And we feel so much better. It feels better to have that initial conversation because our fears with aging and everything else are always much larger than the reality.
Hmm. I want to come back to this idea of internal ageism. Because you write about how we're kind of flooded with these stereotypes, and we mention how we don't really examine them. You talk about how they, when we don't challenge them, they become fixed. They become, I think is how you put it, these premature cognitive commitments. Because you say basically there's this expectation of impairment. It has this kind of physiological or psychological impact on us.
Right. Well, we blame things on age. I mean, they do become, in essence, self-fulfilling prophecies.
Right.
I love there's an example of that you can tie a baby elephant up with a clothesline. And it learns it can't get away. That same clothesline will do the job when the elephant is the size of a Volkswagen because it never thinks to push back. As age-related stereotypes become more potentially relevant, we tend to act as though they're the case. And that does become self-fulfilling prophecies, right? We blame every ache and pain. As I say in my TED talk, I stopped blaming my sore knee on being 64, is the age I was at the time, when I realized that my other knee doesn't hurt and it's just as old. There's my favorite test on this. It was conducted by most of the research is done by a woman named Becca Levy out of Yale School of Public Health, who does terrific stuff. And they flashed words on a computer screen too rapidly for you to be conscious of them. And the negative ones I remember were Florida and bingo. And I'm sure incapacitated and, nursing home, other scary, scary words. And the group that had been negatively primed, which is to say shown the negative words, college kids walked to the elevator measurably more slowly than the control group that had been shown non-negative words. So imagine if those words could cause college kids subliminally to slow down, even though there was no reason. Imagine what the effect is of a lifetime of those messages on those of us for whom they're more relevant. We internalize them, we don't stop to question them, and they are really bad for us psychologically, socially, and physically.
You write about how this, the idea of being less mobile, you say, as you get older, is not one of those things that necessarily keeps you up at night. But what does, and I think this applies to a lot of us who feel this way. It's not the fact that our, joints are going to ache. It's the idea of losing our minds, of getting dementia. And it seems so inevitable as people just get and live older, but you really push back on this. This is how you put it in the book.
It's not inevitable.
Yeah, you say fear is out of proportion for the actual threat. So talk
hugely
a little bit about that.
Hugely. For one thing, about 20% of the population seems to escape cognitive decline entirely. And think about it. We all know some of those really sharp 80 and 90-year-olds. Secondly, the odds do increase with age. One of the statistics that knocked my socks off at the very beginning was I thought the odds of ending up in a nursing home were pretty good. When I started this project, the percentage of the American population over 65 in nursing homes was 4%. In a decade, it's down to 2.5. Now, most of those people, most of them are in their 80s and 90s and even beyond. So they're at the much older end of the spectrum. And most of them are incapacitated by dementia of some kind. And it is a terrible, terrible disease. This is not to minimize the nature of the disease or its, the fact that it is a serious public health challenge.
Sure.
But 1 out of 10 people over 65 are diagnosed. They're somewhere on the spectrum between early diagnosis and incapacitated with Alzheimer's. 1 out of 10, that's a stat from the Alzheimer's Association. I do not cherry pick my data. That means that Alzheimer's is not typical of aging, right? When you forget the name of the movie you saw with what's-her-name, you know, and you're first of all, kids forget stuff too all the time,
right,
which we forget.
Yeah.
Secondly, that most of us do lose some processing speed and capacity in that kind of short-term memory, but we don't lose much more. And it doesn't keep us from being able to function in the world effectively. It may take us longer to find our slippers, but we find them and we make our way in the world. The point, again, is that our fears, the real epidemic is anxiety over memory loss. And I want to bring it back to attitudes towards aging because most people, lest you think this is just another liberal political rant about oppression, the link between attitudes towards aging and how our bodies and our minds function is clearer and clearer. People with more, I used to say more positive feelings about aging. Now I say more realistic, because this is not happy talk. This is what the data shows. People with more realistic feelings about aging not only live longer and walk faster and recover more quickly from severe disability. That's a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And scientists do not speak in those unequivocal terms unless they are really sure of their data. But get this, they are less likely to develop Alzheimer's, even if they have the gene that predisposes them to the disease. The theory is that these positive beliefs buffer us against the effects of stress and prejudice, and those are the effects of living in an ageist world. And that is why I think one of the most powerful, politically neutral reasons to mobilize against ageism would be a ways to do so would be a public health campaign, an anti-ageism campaign as a public health initiative to increase health span, right? We're already living these longer lives. We want to increase the amount of that time that we are as healthy as possible. Let's have an anti-ageism campaign to keep, to stop and block those false beliefs before they cripple the not just our sense of ourselves in the world, but the way our minds and bodies function.
I want to come back to that here in a moment. I want to, though, ask you about something you mentioned a few places, in fact, in the book, and that is like this connection between age and wisdom. You say because people often think of wisdom as something that comes from, you know, kind of passive people. You stay away from it. In fact, you say we tend to idealize wisdom. And you also say in the book at some point that we place older people on a pedestal, which is also not a great idea. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. You know, I wouldn't say wisdom is the province of the passive, but the one of a stereotype can be positive as well as negative.
Yeah.
And we do tend to like our older people, especially our older women, sort of quiet and placid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't like them when they get riled up and, you know, ask for too much stuff. So that is true. I don't love the wisdom trope because I have seen children and young people who are wise, and I've seen a lot of older people who don't seem to have learned a thing along the way. And as I mentioned, I don't like giving someone a higher social value, if you will, just because of their age, or a lesser one, right? It cuts both ways. Mm-hmm. Older people, we do gain experience. That is for sure. And if we learn from that experience, for some of us, it does turn into wisdom. But I don't think I think people tend to flaunt it about when it's something that is highly individual and you got to earn it.
Yeah. What do you make of the term and the idea age appropriate?
I give it a giant thumbs down.
Right.
You know, if you for anything, obviously for children, there's stuff that is not appropriate at a given age.
Sure.
But for adults, there is no such thing. This whole idea that you are too young, but more generally too old to be in a given relationship, wear a certain haircut, dress a certain way, do a certain thing, is, to my mind, completely bogus. Mm. I mean, unless your thing is some kind of extreme sports or, you know, climbing up Yosemite, you know, free climbing, most of the things, you know, you want to do, you can continue to do versions of, you know, your entire life long. You can find people of all ages to do them with. So, I mean, even in the field of romance, I have a friend, a lovely woman in her 50s. She'd love to have a boyfriend, but she wants a guy who is, you know, 2 years older than her and can drive at night and doesn't have a, you know, 16, you know, ex-wives lurking.
Right.
And I said, well, have you thought about dating someone younger? And she said, more than 10 years younger? And I said, yeah. And she said, he wouldn't know who Eisenhower was. And I said, how much time do you spend talking about Eisenhower?
Right.
And it's true that he might not know who Eisenhower was. She might not know who Cardi B is. But yeah. That doesn't mean you can't have a friendship. That doesn't mean you can't teach each other. That says nothing. Maybe he's boring. Maybe he's fascinating, right? But it has to do with who the person is and what you have in common, what you might like to do together rather than age.
Hmm. You write about the way we take on the perspective of all of this. There's this, and how it's culturally defined. There's the study you mentioned at four university hospitals where they talked to seriously ill patients who were aged 80 and up. And in this study, they asked them whether they would rather live a year in their present condition, you know, ill, or have less
time. They're very ill.
Really ill. Or have less time but be in excellent health. Now, talk about this, because I thought this was interesting. What does this show?
It is interesting. Yeah, everyone thought, including their caregivers, who were also polled, who were typically family members, but not entirely, everyone thought they would want to be to have less time but be more mobile. And I believe not a single one chose that. This relates to an idea in the book. I went to a journalism seminar at Johns Hopkins early on. And a lecture by a bioethicist that I had, and I had no idea how seminal this would turn out to be. He said his mantra was a Mexican saying that the appearance of the bull looks different when you enter the ring.
Right?
It looks different to the matador than the spectators, which I shortened to the bull looks different. In other words, we don't know what we're going to want until we get there, which relates back to the end of life, you know, thing. Maybe I am going to want that new liver. You know, maybe I'm not. It's going to depend on the shape I am and where I am in my life and who's with me and a whole bunch of things that I don't know. The point when it comes to illness and disability is that we tend, in an ageist and ableist society, we tend to grossly underestimate the quality of life of people who are old, of people who are disabled, of people who seem to us less fortunate. We project our anxieties on them. And, you know, I used to say when, you know, I would see the little old lady, air quotes around that, but that is how I used to think, you know, hobbling across the street, clutching her walker, I would think, put me out of my misery if I ever get like that. And now I understand just how arrogant it is to assume we can ever know what another person is thinking. Psychologists call this the psychologist fallacy, right? We can never know. And to assume, you know, maybe she's going off to meet her fabulous boyfriend. You know, maybe she's coming home with her chicken cutlets and is going to cook them up and have a lovely evening. We just don't know. So we have to check our own biases when we presume that the quality of life, even people with extreme Alzheimer's, you know, with severe dementia, report that they still feel like themselves and have moments of happiness and grace, which again is not to in any way diminish the tremendous challenge of caring for them and the burden on the people who love them, but still our view from the outside of age, of disability, is much more is crippled by our biases, and it is often way, way, way off base.
I don't want to end the conversation without you mentioning some of the things that we can do to shift this conversation, replace the language that we use, the behaviors, the stereotypes. A couple of places to start. I wanted to go through some of these kind of quickly. One of the things you mentioned, don't compliment an older person by telling her she's different. Like, I can't believe you're 75. Say something quickly about that.
Well, when you tell me, you know, right, I'm, you know, I can't believe you're 75, or, you know, whatever, that person can only accept the compliment at the expense of everyone else their age who just doesn't happen to be able to, you know, bench press 200 pounds or, you know, pick shoes that match her hat, whatever. So it also challenges the idea that people of a certain age look a certain way, behave a certain way. Yeah. Remember, as we get older, your age says less and less and less about what you're capable of physically or mentally. So, you know, to just say that was a heck of a bench press or you look really sharp today, because age does not have much to do with it.
Yeah.
I did come up the other snappy answer. I've solved the problem of what to call old people. And I do have the snappy answer for what to say when someone says you look good for your age. You say you look good for your age, too.
Yeah, it's perfect.
And let that silence sit there, which is uncomfortable, but then the person has to think about, you know, why something they meant as a compliment doesn't feel like a compliment.
Yeah.
And it's because it references age. Because, I mean, why would you call me young lady? I'm not a young lady. And you're just casting light on the fact that I'm not young, and it is embarrassing to be called out as older until we quit being embarrassed about it. Mm. Once you start to see this stuff, these biases in yourself, which is the really uncomfortable part, then you start to see it in the culture at large. And that is really liberating.
Don't use words you say for older people that you wouldn't apply to younger ones, like spry and feisty and kindly. Say something
right.
about that,
I mean,
quickly.
Yeah. Well, we're back to you know, don't call people something you wouldn't want to be called yourself. An older woman came up to me after a talk recently, and she said people always – and she was – I never know how old people are, but certainly in her 70s, if not her 80s. And she said when she's walking along with her boyfriend, people say, oh, aren't you adorable? And I think, if she has the courage to just say, would you like us to call you adorable?
Yeah.
You know, what is the thing the person would like to be called? When we use words like young at heart or even just young and old to mean general, like young at heart, what's that supposed to mean? Playful? Mm-hmm. Well, lots of older people are playful. Lots of younger people are not. It is not an age-dependent characteristic. We say, I don't feel old. What we typically mean is I don't feel ill or incompetent mm-hmm. or invisible. Well, I felt all those things at 13, way worse than I did now. So a really easy thing to do is just look at the way you use the words old and young. And, another thing, like, are you, and we all do this again, but do you tend to blame things on age when it's not? I'm too old to do that. Mm. To learn something new, whatever, to climb that mountain. You may be too lazy. You may be too smart. You may be too sick. You may be too busy with something else. But age is never the reason. Mm.
I love this one. And this is how you put it in the book. Look for beauty in older faces and bodies. It is there.
Yes. One of the sections I like best in the new edition of the book is this passage about how learning to look and see differently is a radical act. I quote a woman named Lindy West, who has written a lot about being fat and how we should think differently about that. And she did an experiment where she stared at parts of people's bodies that she had always despised on herself, like arm fat and belly fat, and looking at them and determined to see beauty in them. And she succeeded. This is a radical ask. It is the task of a lifetime. We can only embark on it with others, but it is absolutely essential, especially for women. I mean, it's sort of ironic one of the things we women are up against is that the idea that the most important thing about us is how we look. Mm. And it's sort of absurd to say, it's not the most radical thing you can do, but it is really radical to learn to look differently, to wipe our minds free of this idea. You know, who says wrinkles are ugly? There's a great quote from Frances McDormand who says the line between her nose and her mouth on one side is she credits to her son for every time she went, oh my God, or wow, you know, our wrinkles are the map of our lives. We find wrinkles in, you know, we find old furniture and chipped ceramics and exploded flowers beautiful. It is an arbitrary measure, right? We can change the way we see, and we need to.
Well, that leads me to this finally. One of the things you write about is how the culture seems to be shifting at least for how we think about and talk about gender, for example, that it's, you know, not as binary as we thought, or it's more fluid than we thought. And you mentioned body shape just a moment ago. Do you think that we can get to that kind of attitude related to age? Do you think we can get there?
I absolutely do. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. We need a grassroots movement to raise awareness of ageism, just like the women's movement. What happened in the women's movement was that women came together and compared notes and realized that things they had been thinking of as personal problems, like getting harassed, not getting hired, not getting equal pay, were not personal problems. They were widely shared political problems that required collective action. That is right where we are with aging. When, right as it is now, we think when you can't open the damn jar or there's no railing or whatever, you think I should be more sturdy, I should be better prepared, I shouldn't go to that theater anymore. No. there should be a damn railing, and the bottle should be easier to open. We need to change aging from a personal problem to a political, collective issue that we can come together and do something about. The disability rights activists did this brilliantly in the 70s and 80s around disability. That is to say, changed it from a personal affliction to a social problem that required political action. And the perfect example is the formulation that the problem is not that I'm in a wheelchair. The problem is that there are stairs between where we are and where we want to go. The problem is not that women are get wrinkles, right? The problem is not that parts of our bodies deteriorate over time. The problem is that we live in a society that uses those against us to reduce us, our visibility, our productivity, our value as human beings. And that needs to be addressed as a grassroots movement, which leads to, you know, collective action, which leads to policy and legal changes. And that process of coming, of shifting from saying, oh, you know, this is just the way things are, I'm stuck with this, to saying, no, this is a collective issue that we can come together and do something about. It's called cognitive liberation. And I love that term. I think I like it because it speaks to the nerd in me and the activist in me. But it is liberating, right? When you start to see that you can do something about it. And that is the linchpin of movement building. And I have just traveled across the country and back a couple times on a book tour. And I can tell you that people are thinking and talking about changing the way we think about aging in a strategic way in all different sectors. And it is really happening.
Ashton Applewhite. Her book is This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. She joined us from NPR in New York. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.